If you have your own story of being in a cult or a high control group, or if you've had an experience with manipulation or abuse of power you'd like to share, leave us a message on our hotline number at 513-900-2955.
Or shoot us an email at trustmepod@gmail.com.
Trust me.
Dude, you trust me.
Trust me. I'm like a smart person.
Yeah, I've never lied to you. I never have lied to you.
If you think that one person has all the answers,
don't.
Welcome to Trust Me, the podcast about cults, extreme belief, and the abuse of power from two cuties who've actually experienced it. I am your favorite cutie, Lola Blanc.
And I am Megan Elizabeth, also a cutie favorite.
An equal favorite.
Yes.
Doubly favorite cuties here.
Double cutie.
Double fave. Okay. Today is part one of our interview with Christina Babin. She is a survivor of the Children of God. She's going to tell us about growing up in the cult, being separated from her family and moving from country to country, as well as the group's love bombing, flirty fishing, and child sexual abuse practices put into place by the leader, David Berg.
Yeah, we'll also discuss what it was like being sent away to abusive punishment camps in Japan and the Philippines, being trapped on a compound with armed guards surrounding the perimeter, and some of the many control tactics, including taping the children's mouths shut if they laughed.
Yeah, it's pretty harrowing stuff. So heads up, content warning. We obviously definitely talk about child abuse. Skip this one if that is too much for you. And in part two next week, we will get into the lighter side of things. We'll talk about how she finally came to leave the group, her first taste of freedom, and so much more. But before we begin our journey with Christina Babin, I would like to know something, Megan, and that is, what is the cultiest thing that has happened to you this week?
Ooh, the cultiest thing that has happened to me this week. I feel a little bit like this one isn't my best, but it is something that's happening to me this week, which is maybe some girls out there can relate. I just started the Tracy Anderson workout program. Have you ever done this, Lola?
I don't think I've ever done any workout program, so
okay. No. Well, I've heard about it. People always are obsessed. I've never wanted to whatsoever, but I've started doing it and I'm becoming one of those people who won't do anything else. So it's happening. I didn't want it to happen. I didn't expect it to happen, but here it is. I'm a Tracy Anderson workout person now.
What do you like about it?
It's just really weird. She's really weird. Also, I just saw at the checkout at the grocery store, she has an entire magazine like Oprah called like Tracy
really?
Anderson. Yes.
Oh, she's building an empire, that Tracy.
She's building an empire. I mean, every single page of the magazine has a picture of her in it.
Oh, my God.
It's like Oprah times 90.
I don't know anything about this person. I have to see what she looks like now. Okay. Tracy Anderson is a white lady mm-hmm. who is skinny and has abs. Okay. Blonde. Yep. Fake lips. All right.
Yeah,
carry on.
You nailed her. It's Tracy Anderson. Woo. And now I'm just kind of like, where have you been all my life, Tracy Anderson? Considered buying the magazine the other day. That's insane. Not doing that. But it's just happening. My mind is being taken over. And she does these speeches at the end of her class. They make no sense. She did a 2-minute speech. I was like, what are you talking about? But
what was she talking about?
Is this helicopter flying over? It's probably Tracy. It's probably Tracy landing on my house right now. Okay, I think it's gone. But so it's the end of the class and she's like, listen, working out has to come from the inside out. You can't have it come from the outside and you can't just mimic me, because if we do this move and you're doing it from the outside in, then you're going to fall down. But if you're doing it from the outside out, then you're going to be in your own body. And I was like, that makes no sense. That doesn't make sense. That's not true.
Work out from the inside in. And it works great for me, to be honest. That's so dumb.
Yeah.
Like, it makes sense from if you're doing yoga, but for just like a workout program.
It just didn't. I didn't get it. I rewound. I kept listening because now she is my cult leader. And I'm like, makes sense to me, Tracy Anderson. Like, I want to know what you're saying. But then I was just like, but you're saying something so dumb that it doesn't matter. So
you kept listening. And now that repetition is planting seeds in your brain
yeah.
that are growing until you are a Tracy Anderson robot.
Right.
But Tracy Anderson robots, hot.
Yes. Gwyneth Paltrow is a Tracy Anderson robot. So
is
I'm
she?
On the right track. Yeah.
That makes total sense. Mm-hmm.
Completely. What about you? What's the cultiest thing that happened to you?
I mean, this is a terrible one because I was not paying attention at all. But I watched the first episode or maybe two episodes, literally can't remember, of Nine Perfect Strangers, the new Nicole Kidman as a cult leader show.
Right.
Do you, have you seen
it? I have not. No, sorry. Is that what you were waiting for? No, I haven't.
Well, Nicole Kidman plays a new agey wellness cult leader who's hosting a wellness retreat. And these 10 stressed out people are all have come from all different kinds of life. And I mean, not that many different kinds of life. A bunch of white people are showing up at this place pretty much to de-stress and listen to what this wise lady has to say. She like has them all lie in coffins in the ground.
Oh.
She is talking a bunch of charismatic nonsense. For me personally, I have seen so many cult movies and shows because aside from this podcast, I also have been working on a feature for my entire fucking life that I'm never going to finish. I'm totally going to finish it.
Of course you
I'm
are.
Rewriting it right now. That is inspired by some of my own experiences. So there is a cult leader in it. So me watching it, I'm like a little bit like, yeah, whatever. I've seen this a million times. However, people who have who are maybe a little bit less immersed in cult material than me are loving the show. If you guys like cult stuff, you'll probably like it. Nicole Kidman has an accent and it actually is like, I mean, I think she does a great job. She totally like captures that kind of character.
What kind of accent?
I don't know. I, again, barely paying attention. Okay, so her name, her character's name on the show is Masha Dmitrychenko. So maybe Russian?
Oh.
No idea.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But anyway, Melissa McCarthy's in it. And Melissa McCarthy is, I think, also the executive producer or an executive producer. And she's playing a serious role, which is fun to see her in. And I liked that.
Is she nailing it?
She's nailing it.
Great.
No, it's great. It's great to see her stretching her, you know, acting chops.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I, again, barely paying attention. However, I'm pretty sure this is the wrong takeaway from the show, but Dannon and I were watching it. Shout out to my friend Dannon. And we were like, we should go to a wellness retreat.
Yeah, no, that's
that
not.
That seems like a thing that we should
that is
do.
Not the takeaway that you are supposed to. You are correct.
So then I spent 45 minutes Googling affordable wellness retreats. Turns out there aren't any, which makes absolute sense.
Well, there sense. Are in Thailand. Did you see any Thailand wellness retreats?
I did see some overseas wellness retreats that were affordable. However, inherently, to get overseas, it costs a fair amount of money. Anyway, probably not going to do that, but it sounds really nice. You know, not just like a really mild, like no real leader, but just like some yoga, some meditation.
Why not?
Just
yeah,
a
sure.
chance to unwind, de-stress. As we all know, my anxiety this month has been pretty horrific. So, you know, I'm just looking for a chance to get some R&R, but I'm not going to do it with Nicole Kidman. All right. That's my story.
Maybe you could join a cult that has this as part of the like indoctrination and then leave.
So I feel like it's hard to do that. But because once it's working, you're like, well, now I have to stay.
Right. But the rest of us would come save you. We would get you.
OK, trust me, listeners, if I joined a cult that was working for my anxiety and it was working so well that I didn't want to leave and I felt like I had to stay, would you all gather in a crowd and come save me? Poll.
Please send us your answer to that on Instagram.
Y or N. Please DM us. Okay. I'm doing okay. It's fine. Doing great. Let's start the interview now.
Okay.
Welcome, Christina Babin.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Thanks for being here. So, all right. Your story is, wow, incredibly harrowing. You know, as I think you saw, we've had someone who was in the Children of God on the show, but she was only in when she was younger. And your experience is just like shocking. So can you start us at the beginning and tell us just like, how did you end up in the group? Like, how did your parents end up in it? What was the situation?
So the Children of God was a fundamentalist type of Christian group that started in 1969 by David Berg. He was a failed Christian minister. He was studying communism and socialism in college, and he decided to target the youth of that time. And that was, there was a lot of turmoil going on in the world, and he found the youngsters very open to a sort of rebellious philosophy. Mm-hmm. And most of our parents joined during that time. And it was a very puritanical, very pure, it was a rejection of capitalism, a rejection of traditional Christianity in a more pure way. It wasn't looked at like, oh, we're going to be this crazy sex cult. It was, we're going to be a pure, original Christian type of group that we're going to be part of.
I mean, sounds good so far in theory, right?
Yeah. Actually, they used music and dancing and a lot of love bombing, constant happiness and smiles that never ended. Mm. A lot of community, just a lot of beautiful young people in long hippie skirts singing and dancing on the beaches. They would pass out peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
Mm.
And it was just, you know, they were ripe for the picking during that time. So my mom, she had already given birth to me and my older brother, and it looked like a beautiful world to raise her children in. And so she jumped in with both feet and both kids. And yeah.
And your mom, was she married?
She was at the time, or was just getting a divorce at the time.
Mm.
And so she joined the cult, and the cult automatically like took us and hid us. And eventually sent us overseas. They did an arranged marriage with my mom with somebody that she had met.
Whoa.
Yeah.
How long did that take to get her into a new marriage?
I'm not sure of the details. You know, that's a story I hope one day my mom will tell.
Mm.
But yeah, there was a lot of back and forth of kidnapping us back and forth. And
wow.
They kind of kept it out of the court. But the cult ended up winning. And
really
whisked away. Yeah.
It was the cult versus your dad fighting for custody, or?
My dad and my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
This is very common in destructive groups. One person will want to join and the other won't. And then the cult comes along with this big community and convinces them, we're going to take care of you and your kids. And everybody outside of the cult is considered bad. So we're going to rescue you from this bad man who's trying to raise your children in America, which is horrible.
Mm.
So that's kind of where it all started. And we were kind of shuttled around. I think it was 1972. The founder wrote a letter. He communicated to all of his followers through letters. And he had leadership that he mandated these letters to, and they supervised, and they would go around visiting different communes and making sure everybody was fulfilling the letters and doing what they were supposed to do. It was very much a pyramid scheme or a pyramid of leadership, with most of us being on the bottom.
Right.
So during 1972, he said, everybody needs to leave America. We need to all go overseas. And everybody started leaving. It was called the Great Escape.
Mm.
And once he got everybody overseas, that's when his doctrine started to change from a more traditional Christian philosophy to where he started incorporating his own insidious ideas, especially on sex. So 1973, he started putting out the first sexual letters. It kind of came in like batches. 1972, he did One Wife. And what that philosophy was, it basically was disbanding of the nuclear families. So in other words, there is no traditional husband and wife, mother and father. We are all one family. It was very interesting, though, that he put One Wife as the title. That's kind of a shocking statement. But then as you read it, it's just like, oh, we're one family. We can all be mothers and fathers. We're all married to each other. Well, 1 year later, he did, I think it was the Law of Love, where he said, okay, since we're all one wife, now we should also be sharing sexually with each other. You know, we're sharing everything else. So he started a kind of a swinger culture. And then a year after that, he instated and started talking about doing flirty fishing, which was a form of prostitution. So it was kind of a slow, gradual thing. But before he started any of that, he took everybody away from their families, away from their country. We were already all on the run. I remember going from country to country, fleeing authorities. I remember being kicked out of Jamaica. We went to Puerto Rico. The government there, they kicked us out because they said we were CIA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So then we ran to Puerto Rico, and we were just always running from the law, running from any form of authority, because we were living outside of that system.
I'm just thinking, you know, it's called the Great Escape. So I'm assuming you guys are feeling under a lot of stress. And I remember reading in an article you speaking about how your bedtime stories were like apocalyptic nightmare, the world's about to end. So is that what you're running from? Like, this must be incredibly stressful.
Absolutely. We believed that the end of the world was coming upon us soon. We believed that America was going to be destroyed. The Antichrist was going to seize power, and we were all going to be martyrs. But we had a mission to accomplish before that day came. And so we did need to escape and do as much, we called it witnessing, and as much proselytizing as we could to ensure that as many people on earth could have the chance to be saved before the end of the world. So we were running from a good many things.
Wow.
We were deceived on every side.
Yeah.
Were you actually running from the law in the United States?
Right. David Berg officially was the one that the authorities were targeting in the early 70s. I believe that Interpol ended up putting out something looking for him. There was like a reward and stuff looking for him. But because none of the children were being schooled in a traditional way, because hundreds of people would be living in one house, because we would be invading churches or standing on the street corners, the law was never on our side. So in our eyes, we were being persecuted. And everything that he was saying kind of matched up with how people were treating us. So in America, you know, you don't get away with a lot of those things the way that we were able to in other countries. In other countries, they were like, oh, crazy foreigners. These crazy Americans always doing what they want, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a very, very smart move. There's not only a statute of limitations, there's a limitation of borders. And not every country has extradition laws. Man, this was the largest conspiracy with children that was successful in training the children to cover up abuse and what was done. We were a well-trained army. I mean, I don't doubt that he believed that he was some kind of messiah and that he believed what he was saying. But we know that humans can convince themselves.
Right.
But the adults, and especially the leadership, they knew what was happening. It was interesting because in 1978, when the Jonestown massacre happened, the founder actually disbanded the cult at that time, like after that happened, and changed the name. So the cult went from the Children of God to the Family of Love, to the Family, then to the Family International.
Which is what they are now.
Yes. So every time that some kind of major thing happened where it started looking bad for the group, the name would change.
Right. Classic move.
Yes. So classic.
Unreal.
You left the United States. And so what was your trajectory? Where were all the places you lived?
So we went to Jamaica, then Puerto Rico, then we went to Canada. We drove through the U.S. I don't know how long that took, but we drove through the U.S. to Mexico and back up to California. And we left from California. We lived in Hawaii, Guam, Saipan, Japan, the Philippines.
Wow.
And then back around again.
Who's paying? Like, how do you guys get the money to do all of this?
Yes, follow the money. That's a very important aspect of the cult that a lot of people don't talk about. I find that everybody is so fascinated with the sexual aspects that we forget some of the most important part of this besides the sexual abuse. It was like 1974 was when he first started talking about flirty fishing. So basically all the women in the cult became prostitutes. You know, some of them fought against it. It was definitely not something that any of the women joined to do. Right. But nobody was allowed to work outside of the cult. It was against the rules. If you took a job, you were automatically excommunicated, rejected, and you were going to die a horrible, fiery death. Wow. And possibly lose your children. So like there was no way to make money. So David Berg came up with this new mission that the ultimate form of love was sex. And that was the thing that, oh, we can minister to people outside by giving them sex. And then they in turn can give us money. They would do it on their own. They would be part of escort services. And all of us little girls, we all watch the women put the makeup on and put the perfume on, which was something that was not allowed in the group unless you were actually going to be a prostitute. So we would watch that. And that's what we all kind of aspire to be like, oh, we'll get to go get dressed up. And that was, if we lived long enough, then we could do that. Chances were we knew we were going to die before that.
Because the apocalypse was coming. Right.
Yeah. Because Jesus was coming back, right? Like the world was about to end.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But if something happened and you did it, then that was our only future. Like that's what women were here to do. So that went on for quite a while.
How old were you when you're observing all of this?
So that was my whole time growing up because I was born in 1974. So it was a very strange way of growing up. And that went all the way up into the 80s. And I want to say that it was like maybe 87. Yeah, it was almost in the 90s when they said no more. And they decided not to do FFing anymore, which was flirty fishing, unless you already had a John that was already an established John. They say, oh, we stopped it 1987. But the thing is, it didn't stop. They just stopped gathering new Johns.
So this is like an official declaration from the top that you are going to flirty fish. You're going to go out there. You're going to pull in men and get their money.
Yeah.
How was this information disseminated?
So Father David wrote letters and the letters were printed up and they came in the mail. And then he had leadership that would come around and inspect, and they would travel and make sure that you were doing what you were supposed to be doing. So it was interesting because during the disbandment that happened after the Jonestown, part of that was kind of a reorganization process. There were a lot of people that were not happy with the flirty fishing and the things that were going on. So basically he kind of disbanded and then rebanded. So when you rebanded back with the group, you kind of had to agree to these terms. So that was your chance to get out if you weren't all on board with all of his doctrine.
Right.
So that was going on for a while, but also at the same time, because it's not enough for a few women to, you know, bring in money. We also had to have more money just to have houses and to be able to go out. So the children also were the breadwinners. And so during the day, we would go out and we would sing on the street corners. We would pass out tracts. We would beg for money and food. And so that was the two forms of income. The men would drive the women around and drive the children around. And that's how it worked. The women and children were the breadwinners.
And what were the men doing all day?
They were driving us around.
That's it. They were just like supporting the sex trafficking. Okay, cool.
They helped, you know, count the money and they played the guitar. And
wow.
I mean, there's still work to be done. They weren't laying around eating bonbons. They were busy. Remember, there were so many children. So each woman had like 8 to 12 children.
Oh my God.
So you have one man and one woman for that many children. So the men were driving a lot of people around.
Wow. That's really interesting. It's like a reverse polygamy situation where the men are the ones taking care of all the children.
Yeah. Well, no, the men didn't take care of the children either. So
no, they didn't? Okay. Sounds like a great deal for the women.
Yes. And then the men were rewarded at night by, they had sharing schedules. So all the women and also the older children, the older kids would also be put on these sharing schedules. And so they would, every night, the leadership would decide, okay, now you're going to sleep with so-and-so and you're going to sleep with so-and-so.
Oh my gosh.
And if you're of what we think is an appropriate age, then, you know, this man's going to teach you how to have sex, or this woman's going to teach you how to have sex.
My gosh.
Usually 12, right? It was 12, the norm.
That's what a lot of it was. Now, younger kids also did experience that as well, but usually with like the sharing schedules, it was like older children to younger teenagers.
Sharing schedules is such a like benign term for such a horrific thing that it's actually referring to. That's like, it's just so creepy.
But it was seen in our world as a beautiful form of self-sacrifice and a beautiful way of showing love. And we were taught that it was a beautiful, wonderful thing. We were told that Al-Qaeda did not like it and that it was considered a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just quite normal for us. Most of us did not like it, though. But since it was taught as also a sacrifice, it kind of made sense. Like, so it was kind of confusing because you were like, ooh, I'm not into this.
Right.
But they say it's good.
But it's right that I'm not into this. Because I'm sacrificing.
You grow up thinking something's wrong with you because everybody around you is endorsing it and you're not allowed to talk about it.
Right.
So you kind of think like, okay, I don't like it, but it's not abuse. It's just, I'm a weirdo.
Right. Right.
Mm.
We did a lot of practicing and training to not tell outsiders the truth. That was like part of our routine was we would do mock court cases. We would do mock raids where adults would pretend to be authorities and the children had to answer correctly, behave correctly, never show signs of stress, only show signs of happiness. And that was part of our everyday life. So when the world kind of started taking notice of what was happening, communes were raided around the world and children were taken away. And when they did that and they were questioning the children, they found all the children very happy and very stress-free. And very in control of what they were saying. The children knew exactly what to say. So they were like, oh, well, I guess there's nothing bad going on, despite all the literature, which was very obviously promoting abuse.
Right.
We talked about how flirty fishing was implemented, but can you talk about how he actually dictated that child abuse was good and the thing to do?
So David Berg was our voice of God for us.
Right.
Everything that he said was supposed to be followed. We all tried to copy his behavior and be more like him. So he started out, like I said, he started out with the one wife. And then in these letters, he was slowly let out more and more about his own life and how he was abused as a child. And he enjoyed it. He felt a lot of shame around that. And his mother shamed him a lot when she caught him masturbating and things like that. So he would share these things and then share his opinions. And then he would have like a revelation, you know, so he would be kind of prepping you and saying these things in his letters. And then he would come out, oh, well, here, we should all be one wife. And then a little more prepping over the next year. And then, oh, well, now I just came up with this thing called the law of love, which means anything that is done in love is good and pure. And then he would prep you a little more and then say, you know what? It's not a bad thing for children to have sex. You were already so prepped by that time. And it just slowly escalated. Like, it's that one little saying of you put a frog in hot water and it's going to jump out.
Yeah.
But if you put a frog in cold water and slowly turn up the heat, the frog is going to boil, but never jump out because it doesn't realize what is happening.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so that's what was happening for sure to our parents. And then because we were one wife and all of the children were cared for by different people, and actually once you got to be a certain age, they would try to send you to a different commune. And so you would live away from your parents with other adults. So you weren't seeing necessarily these things being done to your kids. Some parents did, but others had no idea because, you know, they weren't doing it to their kid.
Right.
They weren't on the sharing schedule with their own kid. It was another commune.
Oh, so sneaky.
But one thing that I really want to emphasize is that while this was a sex cult, the sex was only a fraction of what we experienced. It's the part that everybody wants to talk about and that everybody is fascinated with. But the mind control and the thought reform programs that we had to go through were incredibly difficult. You know, we were not given an education. When we started to rebel, they made camps that they put us into that were just full of mind control tactics and public beatings. A lot of fear was installed in us. It was very, very difficult. And during those times, it was not about sexual abuse. So this was a group about control. And this was one of the most successful groups when it comes to having a beautiful storefront, having horrible things going on behind, and then getting away with it.
Yeah.
So what's happening now is I'm only one of many that are coming out now. We are coming out and we're saying, okay, no matter what we said when we were children, this actually happened.
Right.
But it took me 10 years after leaving the cult to even admit to myself that it was abuse.
Right.
It took me a long, long time. I was just telling myself, I didn't like it. I don't enjoy this lifestyle. It must not be for me.
Right.
But it took so long. And then it took me another 10 years or so before I felt I could share it publicly.
Wow. So you were sent to a camp. Did that mean that you had been rebellious? Were you rebelling against the like lifestyle? Like what was happening that led them to send you to this place?
So really, I think all of us kind of were, you know, there were a couple kids that it kind of started out with where maybe they stole something or they had a rebellious attitude. But really, like if you got caught singing an outsider song that you heard somewhere, if they caught you with a book or they caught you with lipstick, you know, if they caught you with anything, if your attitude just wasn't right. So basically, most of us went through one of these camps. And there were different levels of camps. The initial ones were a very clever way of starting the trafficking of us. So they said, we're sending all of the kids that are 12 and up to this camp. And they did, I think it was 12 camps around the world.
Wow.
So all these kids went to this camp. It was like a month or two long. It was basically heavy, heavy indoctrination. It was all of Robert Lipton's 8 thought reform criteria, you know, that they used on us. They didn't use a lot of physical abuse or sexual abuse, but it was just all the manipulation and the mind control. So then when that camp was over, instead of sending us back to our parents, they then dispersed us around the world and they just trafficked us from commune to commune as often as they could. They just kept us moving. We didn't know where our parents were. They didn't know where we were. You know, if you got a letter, you were lucky, but they never got to send the letter to the home. They would send it to World Services and then World Services would send it to us.
Oh, man.
There were years where I never heard from my family.
Can you give us some examples of some of the tactics that they would use that fall under those 8 criteria?
Okay. So, well, the first one, which is, I think is the most important, is the milieu control, which is the French word for, you know, your surroundings. They control everything that comes in and out. Everything around you is controlled. And then it goes to all the information that comes into your head is controlled. And then your thoughts are controlled. So it starts with no leaving compounds, nobody coming in, no books coming into the compound, no conversations that are not repeating the prophet's words. And then you started tattling on yourself and your thoughts and your mind. You weren't allowed to think. It was constant memorization, constant quoting of the scripture. You never went anywhere alone. You did not go to the restroom alone. You showered together. There was no alone time. You didn't go into the closet alone. Being alone was a form of punishment. So they would put you in isolation and solitary confinement for months, sometimes 6 months.
Oh my gosh.
You were put on silence restriction with signs on you or duct tape on your mouth saying, I'm not allowed to speak to anybody.
Wow.
So a lot of those things, maybe not the silence restriction, but the milieu control was also something that they used on our parents as well. They didn't go anywhere by themselves, at least compared to most people. You know, they always had somebody with them. And I'm guessing when they were flirty fishing that they got to be alone, but with an outsider. But even that, like you had to write reports. Every night we all wrote a report. We reported on ourselves. We reported on other people. We reported on our thoughts. We reported on conversations. It was down to, we reported on how we used the bathroom.
Wow. And would people tell on each other if they saw like any little thing?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. I remember I got in trouble a few times because of things that crept out of my mouth. Mm. And I would try to tattle on other people, but not tattle on people. So I would talk about other people, but not tell on them. Usually I would be like telling on myself. So I would be combining the two. I would be like, oh, I was talking to Johnny today and I started daydreaming about spending time with him. So then I'm like tattling on him because I'm mentioning his name, but I'm really tattling on myself. But then it's nothing too horrible. So they just go, oh, make sure you don't get too attached to Johnny, or we'll make sure not to put you on shifts together, because they did not allow intimate relationships. So you couldn't fall in love with somebody. You couldn't have a friendship because you loved everybody. So if you got too close to somebody, they would separate you.
Wow.
So we really kept it on the down low if that was real. But it was a great way to tattle on yourself. And since we were moved from commune to commune, you could use the same tactics on different leaders. So I would find a tactic that would work, and then I would use that on every leader in every commune to kind of stay on the down low. Yeah.
Like being kind of vague about what you were feeling, or like what did that look like?
No, like I said, I enjoyed somebody's company today more than other people's.
Okay.
That was good.
Okay.
If you confess something like a doubt, then they would do an exorcism on you and public humiliation.
Whoa.
So I was sort of a believer, but sort of not.
Right.
With our lifestyle, I believe that we could not survive on the outside world. I believe we needed each other. I believe I needed the cult. I wasn't totally convinced about the end of the world. I was like, oh yeah, I guess it's possible. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But then I also just was very observant of the adults' behavior and of hypocrisy. And I think I really did believe in God, because I was like, if God is real and he knows I'm doubting in my head, and then Sally over there just got in trouble when I know she believes more than me, I was like, God really is all powerful. He's not going to fall for these tricks.
Right.
And I was like, okay, so he obviously doesn't really care as much as they care.
Right.
So I kind of just like, I don't know if that's cognitive dissonance, but it was making sense in my mind.
That's I feel like that's so observant.
Yeah.
That's actually so smart to even be able to make that observation. I feel like when I would witness hypocrisy, I just would ignore it as a kid. I wouldn't like compare God being omniscient to like the behavior of the adults necessarily, you know?
Yeah.
Well, in our cult, the stakes were so very high.
Right.
You watched other people be tormented and you watched horrible things happen to them. And so it was kind of a sink or swim. So I don't know that I was more observant or more smart than anybody else. I just had a will to survive. And I just was like, okay, I got to somehow make it. And I was watching people be broken around me. And I was like, I don't want to be broken. And eventually they did break me. And there's months that I can't remember after that, where I just lost memory. Yeah, we went to a huge camp in the Philippines, and it was called the Jumbo, because obviously it was massive. And the founder actually lived nearby. We didn't know that, but his ambassadors would come and inspect. And the closer you got to the top, the worse things were. The closer that you got to Berg, the more control, the more sexual abuse, everything was more, I don't know what you call it, insidious. The closer you got to the top, the less freedom you had.
Did you ever meet him?
No, I never did. Mm-hmm. And I never had a desire to. So I was a weirdo in that way. I was never into him. I always had this sick feeling in my stomach when people would get like invited to go stay at his house. I was always like, ooh, for them. Like, oh no. But I never said that, because that was like the worst thing you could say.
Right.
I just was kind of never into that. I was kind of a bad seed. You know, I loved being able to go beg on the streets. I didn't like the begging part, but I loved the opportunity for something to happen, for me to get a glimpse of a television, or I would rip pages of magazines out and like go sneak into the bathroom and read them. And then I would flush them down the toilet. So whoever knew, I just was always looking for some kind of taste of the outside world. I was so curious. I was thirsty for worldliness. Yeah.
And you taught yourself how to read. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, I don't know if it's me, but being one of the older kids, there was a very de-emphasis on education. And the founder said, nobody needs anything more than a sixth grade education. So it wasn't like forbidden to educate your kids. But because our mothers were having so many babies, they were worked to death. And then we older kids were having to take care of all the babies and go out on the streets and beg for money. Like, we had to do all of that and then try to fit some schooling in. So right. What happened was, like, if it was your day to be with the kids, and every family was a little different. So there were some families who were like, okay, well, we're going to make sure all of our kids have a sixth grade education. It's just my family didn't happen to, and a lot of others didn't, but there is diversity even in the cult.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you were teaching the younger children, and we would try to teach the younger children the alphabet and the phonics and stuff. So I knew my alphabet and I knew my phonics, and I was around 10, and my stepdad was like, we figured out I didn't know how to read. And he was like, well, you have to read because you got to read the word of God. And so he plopped down the Bible and he was like, you have till tomorrow to read me something from the Bible.
Whoa.
I was like, oh shit. But I knew the structure of reading, like I knew what I needed. So I just like, I don't remember how late I stayed up, but I kind of took my phonetics and I found some verses that I had memorized because I knew they were in, you know, Ephesians or, you know, 1 John.
Right.
And I found those and then I took the phonics and just the sounds and kind of worked out the concept and then practiced on a couple of the verses. And I was like, oh, okay. So
wow.
Wasn't never really a strong reader, but now I am. I love to read. I read a lot.
That's awesome.
That's so cool.
How did you feel about your stepdad? What was your relationship like with him?
Ooh, that is a tough question. Good and bad. I saw him as my keeper who I was supposed to work for. And if I kept him happy and brought enough money home, then he was happy and not stressed. Mm. So we did not have a close relationship. He joined the cult because he had a difficult life and that bled over into, you know, everything he did. I do have one good memory. He taught me how to sing some Elvis songs, which was absolutely forbidden in the cult.
Mm.
It started in Saipan, and then I ended up spending a little time with them in Japan. And he would take me out to bars at night. And I was very young to be singing in bars, but we would go and sing in bars and bring the money home. So I would work all day long and then go sing at night in the bars and bring the money home.
Wow.
A lot of work for us.
I mean, the trauma is just, it's on every side. It's just so much. I also think I read that you couldn't smile.
No, it's the opposite.
You had to smile.
You had to smile constantly. There was a never-ending happiness that you needed to exude, which was why it was so easy to fool outsiders, because you had to just look pleasant and happy and smile all the time. So getting out into the real world, I found it so complex. People were so complex out here. There wasn't just happiness and then anger and fear.
Mm-hmm.
People had likes and dislikes. Mm-hmm. People had flavors of ice cream that they liked. People had feelings of disapproval. They had feelings of romance. They had feelings mm-hmm. of discontent towards their jobs. There just was so much that I just had never experienced or never had a word for,
right?
You know, because our language was very limited, because you were either happy or you were bad. You know, there was no, I'm depressed.
Right.
There was no depression. You know, there was no elation either. There were only certain times when we would like chant together, which again, all cults have some form of chanting.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. I guess not all, but it is a very common thing.
Common, yeah.
But, you know, so you could be elated in that moment when you were getting high on lack of oxygen because you were chanting so heavily. But laughter and joking, any kind of silliness was absolutely not allowed. So you just had to be smiling and pleasant.
Okay, so maybe it was laughter that would get your mouth taped shut.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Laughter. Got it. Yeah. Got it.
So how does that work with the love bombing? Because when I imagine love bombing, I imagine like giggly hippies dancing around and telling you how great you are. Like, how does that actually work?
That was something that continued all throughout my life. You would do it hardcore with outsiders that you were trying to bring in. You know, you would hug them. You would tell them you love them. You were taught to try to touch them as much as possible. Any excuse you got to touch, hug them, smile at them, tell them you love them. We also did that with each other. So if you visited another commune or came into another commune, everybody would hug you and smile. And we were so authentic in that. And I really do believe it's because we needed each other. We thought we were alone in the world and everybody was out to get us. So you were just like, I love you. You know, you were authentic in that. You would also do it after every punishment. So if you were punished, we would do like public humiliations where the person would be, you know, in the middle of the room and we would all be praying against their evil spirits, against their will, against their pride. And when it was over and the tears were falling and you could tell they were yielded or we were just all exhausted, then the hugging would come. Everybody would rush that person and hug them.
Whoa.
In abusive relationships, it's called like punishment reward.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So you really get like these endorphin rushes and these dopamine rushes. You know, you get brought way down and then you get pulled back up again.
Right.
And you can kind of get addicted to these highs and lows.
Right.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and what extreme lows that I bet the highs after that just felt so high. I mean, it's just like,
yeah,
such extreme manipulation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. We will continue that next week in part two, leaving it there for now. Megan. So I believe we've already discussed whether or not you joined the Children of God, and the answer to my memory was a resounding no.
Yes.
But that's only because of what we know to be true about it, I would imagine. So I guess what I want to know is, do you imagine yourself to be vulnerable to love bombing?
Yes. Extremely, because I love love and I love to be showered in it. So extremely vulnerable. Yes.
So if some girls come up to you at a party and they're like, you look amazing. And they're like, we know this great group that you should join because you're just so amazing. I don't know. Is this how love bombing works? And then you go to the thing and they're like showering you with attention and telling you how much they want to see you come again and how special you are. You'd be like, yeah, sick. I'm going to come back.
I mean, I guess it depends on what they were teaching at the thing, but most likely if it was innocuous enough, sure.
Sure. They're just like chanting or singing or doing yoga something.
That sounds great. I wish this. I would love that. And I can totally see how her mom would get sucked into something like this. Like it so easily.
Yeah, me too. One thing that I thought was interesting was that it seemed like they were sort of initially presenting themselves as like an antidote rebelling against the mainstream because they were promoting like communism and socialism, you know, which is anti-capitalist and whatever. But then the extreme Christian stuff feels like it contradictory to that to me. Is it not? I don't know.
Totally. Yeah, it's so strange. I don't know how they laid that out in a way that made sense for anybody, but it's a very strange compilation of different things over there.
I could totally see that actually working now in this climate. I mean, obviously, if people didn't have all the information about the group, because there are strong, you know, anti-capitalist feelings happening right now. And I could totally see there being some kind of like political leaning, you know, socialism promoting group, but that also appeals to our like roots, our like childhood roots, because so many of us grew up conservative or grew up Christian.
Right.
So it's like kind of marrying those. It's like, oh, you know.
Yeah. Super smart.
Yeah. Also, I will say something that my boyfriend. Oh, I have a boyfriend now, you guys. I have a boyfriend.
Hello.
He's so cute. Something my very smart, funny, sexy boyfriend has brought to my attention, I guess, is just like how Christianity, like actually, you know, for what it is supposed to be, actually is basically socialism. So those two things do not necessarily conflict at all. And the only thing that really conflicts at that point is like the extremism and the, you know, abusiveness, obviously.
Right.
But I don't know. It just felt like an interesting juxtaposition to me. But yeah, and love bombing. I mean, obviously, I would be vulnerable to that. But I am someone who's like distrustful of people who lay it on too thick or like give me too much attention too soon.
Right.
So I wonder if I would be the ideal candidate for that particular recruitment tactic versus like.
You would probably be the ideal candidate for like ignoring Like, that would be like if they just completely ignored you, you'd be like, please, I want to join.
Yeah. If it's an elite group that like I have to yeah. jump over hoops to jump mm-hmm. through hoops. You don't jump over hoops, Lola.
Jump. Look, guys, I jumped right over it. Cool, Lola.
Such a good shot. Yeah. If they don't want me to be a part of it, I feel like that would maybe be more likely to appeal to me. Yeah. But also, that's bullshit because I love attention, y'all. I fucking love attention. Who am I kidding?
Who doesn't? But I think cult-wise, a more elite approach would appeal to you more.
You're right.
Just if anybody wants to get you in a cult, I'm just saying.
It's totally true. The Illuminati would be the yeah. ideal cult for me. Yeah. You know?
Obviously.
I want to feel special and
right.
smart and like, you know, I don't know. I don't fucking know, you guys. But hate bomb me is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Give her some hate bombs. Jeez.
Please don't. Okay. All right. Well, there's much more to get into next week. And yeah. Keep listening. Prince.
Please keep listening. We hope you have an amazing week. Remember to follow your gut, watch out for red flags, and never,
never,
ever,
ever trust me.
Bye.